Welcome to the Old Front Line with me, military historian Paul Reed. This is a regular podcast where we can travel together across the haunting battlefields of the Great War, from Flanders to the Somme and beyond. So what's in this week's episode? Today is the 103rd anniversary of the Battle of Arras, fought in northern France on this day in 1917. Arras, in many ways, is one of the forgotten battles of the First World War, sandwiched as it is between the Somme and the Third Battle of Ypres, commonly known as Passchendaele in 1917. But Arras was an important sector of the Western Front for troops. We took it over from the French in 1916, a full year or more before the actual Battle of Arras, and it became one of those sectors that almost every British unit, every British soldier, served in at some particular point. And it had several high points in the war in which there was intense fighting there, the Battle of Arras in April and May of 1917 being one of those, but again in the spring of 1918, in the Kaiserschlacht of March 1918, the Germans attacked in this area. And in the summer, British and Canadian troops advanced from Arras across and through the Hindenburg Line towards Cambrai and beyond. But today is the anniversary of the 1917 battle. And the Battle of Arras on this day proved, not just with the Canadians, because the Canadian attack at Vimy Ridge in the north was not a separate part of the Battle of Arras, it was an integral part of it. There are many that believe that somehow the Canadians took that ridge entirely under their own steam, having reinvented trench warfare. But the truth is that the whole of the British Expeditionary Force, of which the Canadians were a part, just as the Australians and New Zealanders and South Africans, had gone through this incredible learning process on the Somme, a terribly costly one, but they had learned from it. And the Germans, having withdrawn into the Hindenburg Line, the Siegfriedstellung, in the spring of 1917, made popular recently with the 1917 film, believed that they had pulled back into an almost impregnable position. The fighting at Arras in 1917 would prove otherwise. With the right resources, with the right troops and equipment, and the way to connect all that up with tactics and approach to warfare, you could break through these defences. But Arras became this great killing battle of the First World War, over 159,000 British and Commonwealth casualties in 1917, with a daily casualty rate of more than 4,000 men killed, wounded and missing, which was higher than most other battles. Sure, first day of the Battle of the Somme, there was 57,000 casualties, and there were many other days of the war in which the British Army lost more men, but the attrition rate at Arras was significantly high, and it was a battle where there was a huge amount of artillery, and a very high proportion of the dead from that 1917 battle do not have a known grave. They're commemorated by the Commonwealth War Graves Commission on the Arras Memorial to the Missing. I was very lucky to interview a large number of veterans who fought at Arras in 1917 back in the 1980s. Inspired by books written by Martin Biddlebrook and Lynn MacDonald, I was very keen to interview people who had actually taken part in the Great War, men who had actually been there. And although oral history has its problems, men can misremember things, I found then that these men had suppressed their memories for so long, kept them locked away, that once you found the key to unlocking that, it all came tumbling out as if it was re-remembered for the first time. And I used to cross-check, cross-reference some of the things that they told me, and many of them had absolutely uncanny, clear, sharp memories of what they'd been through. And I think that the personal experience of their service in the trenches, you know, gave me an incredible insight into what that war was about and what it was like for these ordinary men in these extraordinary circumstances. And it's on days like today, the anniversary of the Battle of Arras, that I do think of these men. I think of George Butler. He lived in a care home in Worthing. And I went there to see the Great War veterans that they had. I'd rung them up and said, I understand that you may have some Great War veterans living in your home. And they said, well, how many do you want? So I went to go and visit. And I spoke to the person in charge and said, who should I go and interview first? And she recommended one particular veteran. And I went to speak to this gentleman, and he'd served in the latter part of the war in quite a few different regiments. And it was quite clear that he'd just moved from one unit to another for various reasons. And although he'd been in the trenches, he'd never gone into action, and his war was fairly straightforward, really, from his point of view, and very short. Went back to the same person. I said, well, who shouldn't I go and interview? And she said, oh, Mr. Butler, don't go and talk to him. He's a very disagreeable gentleman. So I went to see Mr. Butler, and I introduced myself. And George Butler was an incredible man, a working class lad born in Manchester. His mother had died when he was young. His father had remarried. He didn't get on with his stepmother. And he'd walked out of the home when he was a young boy, long before the Great War, and lived as a beggar on the streets of Manchester. He used to sleep at night in the cabs of steam trains at Manchester Piccadilly because it was a warm place to sleep at night, and the engine drivers took pity on him. And after about a year of doing this, he said that he was absolutely black and filthy with dirt, crawling with lice. And one of the engine drivers, who was a veteran of the Boer War, said to him, listen, laddie, why don't you just go and join the army? They'll put clothes on your back, food in your stomach, and they'll send you all round the world. So he thought, well, why not? It can't be any worse than this. But he was afraid of his father finding out. So he didn't join the Manchester Regiment. He went up the road to Bury, and he joined the Lancashire Fusiliers in 1910, aged 12. So he was a teenage Tommy, but he was not a soldier that lied about his age. You could join the regular army quite legitimately at that age because it was essentially the school leaving age before the Great War. So he joined as a boy soldier, and he trained as a boy soldier, and 4 years later, he's 16 years old, the Great War is about to break out, and he's now a trained machine gunner. When the war breaks out, he's serving in a battalion of the Lancashire Fusiliers. His commanding officer follows the War Office directives, does not send his young soldiers overseas, although some battalions did do that. We've seen pictures of Private Carter of the Middlesex Regiment, for example, at Mons in 1914, age only 16. But George didn't go. They held him back at the depot. And he later said that he realised how fortuitous this was because it probably saved his life, the battalion having taken very heavy casualties in the 1914 campaign. In early 1915, he was required, he said, to sign a waiver to go overseas, still underage, but they were desperate for trained men like him. So off he went. And he served at Ypres in 1915, and then down on the Somme. He went over the top on the Redan Ridge on the first day of the Battle of the Somme, fought near Le Buff, and on the Morval Ridge towards the end of the Battle of the Somme. And then the unit moved up to Arras, and he spent almost a year in and out of that sector and taking part in the Battle of Arras itself in 1917. On the 9th of April, his machine gun company, because by this stage he transferred from the Lancashire Fusiliers to the 12th Company of the Machine Gun Corps, that was his brigade machine gun company. He was now a sergeant, and there's a photograph that I put up on Twitter today of his machine gun company. He is the most experienced soldier in the photograph. He is the most senior soldier in the photograph, but he is the youngest soldier in the photograph, still only 18 years old. And on the 9th of April 1917, they moved forward with troops from the 4th Division to set up fire support, machine gun support, covering fire for them near to the village of Phampoo. The 4th Division had leapfrogged through the earlier advance of the 9th Scottish Division and taken that area to the east and northeast of Phampoo along the Sunken Lane. And there's a little Sunken Lane cemetery there today, and I often think of George when I go there. He had his machine gun in a shell hole somewhere just beyond that on the night of the 9th of April. As he said, probably the most eastern extremity of the British Army positions on the Arras front on that night. And they were a bit wary as to where the Germans actually were. And George was nervous. He was there in his shell hole with his machine gun team. And the machine gun was set up, but it was dark. There was the rumble of the guns and the staccato of the machine gun fire from the enemy around them. And suddenly they heard a noise behind them, the movement of someone out in what was really no man's land because there were no fixed positions as such here. It was all a little bit all over the place as to where the British were and where the Germans were located. And they saw these figures moving through the darkness towards them. And George, being the number one on the gun, he didn't carry a rifle because he was carrying the weapon and the equipment, all the equipment for the weapon. He carried a sidearm, and he whipped it out, as he said, cowboy style, to take out these figures that were coming through the darkness towards him, when he noticed that rather than the shape of a Pickelhaube, a German spiked helmet, or a Stahlhelm, a steel helmet, it was a battle bowler, a British Tommy's helmet, and these were British soldiers, in fact British officers, coming towards them. So he didn't open fire. The officers jumped down into the shell hole, one of them slid down the side and stood next to him, and he noticed this wasn't just any officer. This officer was minus an arm, and he had an eye patch, and it was Brigadier General Adrian Carton de Wiat, VC. He'd been awarded the Victoria Cross for his bravery on the Somme in 1916, had gone from battalion to brigade commander. He'd been a trooper in the Imperial Yeomanry in the Boer War, an incredible soldier, and had been wounded multiple times. He was not a chateau general by any description whatsoever, a man who was always in the thick of the fighting somewhere. And Carton de Wiat had come forward to see where his brigade was, what positions they held, and was there to gather intelligence. Now, George Butler was a regular soldier, and he didn't like the scruffy trench caps that many soldiers wore in the frontline area, and he very rarely wore his steel helmet, which eventually cost him with quite a serious head wound in 1918, but that's another story. And the cap that he did wear was his pre-war service cap, and he'd not taken the stiffener out, being a regular soldier. And Carton de Wiat, also a regular soldier, saw this and recognised it and said to him, "Sergeant, regular soldier are you?" And George replied, "Yes, sir." He said, "Jolly good show, man." He said, "When this war's over, we'll get back to real soldiering." Which was a favourite phrase of many of the regulars of that period. Not diminishing what the war was, but it was their jokey way of, I suppose, dealing with the very different sort of war that they were in compared to the one that they probably thought they were going to fight when they joined. Now, George went on to fight in many other battles of the Great War. He was badly wounded in the Battle of the Lys in April 1918. He stayed on in the regular army. In fact, he remained in the Machine Gun Corps until its disbandment in 1924, and then returned to the Lancashire Fusiliers. On the outbreak of war in 1939, he was mobilised once more, went across with the British Expeditionary Force, came back via Dunkirk, and then spent the rest of the war training soldiers at the depot of the Lancashire Fusiliers. On World War II tours with Ledger Holidays, I've had veterans of the Lancashire Fusiliers who were trained by him and remembered him. He was by then a Sergeant Major. So an incredible character, lived to a ripe old age, and his memories of the war were absolutely crystal clear. So much so, in fact, that when I used to interview him, he was back there and he would look at me, and I was a young man in my early 20s then. And of course, he was looking into the sort of face that he was when he was there in the trenches of the Great War. And several times he would say to me, "And which unit did you serve in the war?" Thinking that there we were, two contemporaries back in that period. An amazing man. Another veteran that I think of when I think of Arras is a chap called Malcolm Vivian. Different character to George. He was from a very privileged background. He's one of the oldest Cornish families. He was educated at public school, and then he went to Cambridge. Was at Cambridge when the war broke out. He joined a territorial unit of the Royal Garrison Artillery, the Glamorganshire Royal Garrison Artillery, and eventually he became a forward observation officer in the 96th Siege Battery Royal Garrison Artillery, equipped with 9.2-inch howitzers. And as part of the Battle of Arras, his unit had been involved in the preliminary bombardment. One of the issues they had was that their heavy artillery group commander was a gunner officer from the Royal Horse Artillery. He was used to light guns that could move very quickly. A 9.2-inch howitzer had a 2.5-ton dirt box that absorbed the recoil of the gun firing, and it didn't take minutes to pack up and move. It took hours to pack up and move, and something that this officer often struggled with. In the fighting at Arras, Malcolm's job remained as a forward observation officer for the battery. And there's a little sunken lane on the Hindenburg Line battlefields around Cherisy and Fontaine-le-Quasi. And that's where Malcolm was observing for his siege battery during this fighting. They were carrying out something called bunker busting, where they were using aerial photographs and trench maps to work out the precise locations of bunkers, and then they would fire the guns in concentrated fire on the bunkers to try and crack them apart and destroy them, and then get the Royal Flying Corps to go up, take more air photographs to see how successful they had been in that endeavour. Again, this is all indicative, I think, of just how the British Army was moving on. It was becoming a professional army. It was using the technology and equipment and weapons that it had at its disposal to fight these battles in a different way. It didn't just send lines of men into battle time and time again to be mown down. The war moved on almost every month, but always, always at that great cost, the cost of casualties. Anyway, back to Malcolm. Malcolm was there with his favourite signal corporal, a forward observation team in the Royal Artillery, whether it was Royal Field Artillery or Royal Garrison Artillery with the heavier guns, consisted of an officer whose job it was to spot and use the map and work out where the targets were, and a group of signallers who were there alongside him to relay that information back to a relay point that they can be relayed again back to the gun positions. Now, obviously, with no radio to be able to radio through this information, it was fixed signalling. So they were using Lucas lamps, which are very bright signalling lamps, to Morse back a message to a relay point, who would then relay it back to the battery, possibly multiple relay points. Sometimes they use fixed telephone line, but obviously over an extended area, particularly with heavy guns that fired over a long distance, you couldn't always do this. If the Lucas lamps with their batteries broke down or the batteries ran out of juice, it would necessitate the signalers standing on a high point with flags using semaphore to message that information back. And you can imagine on the flat, barren, blasted landscapes of the Great War, just what an inviting target signalers with semaphore flags were standing there doing their job, which is why teams of forward observers and signalers in the Great War suffered such heavy casualties, probably much higher proportion of casualties than other branches of the armed services. There was no raw signals at that time, signalling being done by whatever unit it was in the artillery, by their own signallers, in the infantry, with the signal section of an infantry battalion. Anyway, Malcolm was there on the sunken lane, and he was getting, as he said, rather carried away with doing the bunker busting, and he got right up onto the lip of the sunken lane, looking down at a bunker that was on the slope towards the village of Fontaine-le-Croisic, when his favourite signaller corporal who was with him realised the danger they were in, somehow got a premonition of what was to come, grabbed him by his Sam Brown belt and dragged him down the lane just as a 5.9 landed on the spot where Malcolm had been sitting observing for the guns. As he said, that was very nearly his journey's end. That was very nearly his name added to the Cambridge Roll of Honour. But thankfully not. And Malcolm, again, like George, lived a very, very long life. I was so privileged to know men like these two back in the 1980s. And as we went through the Great War centenary, men like them were always on my mind. And I felt sad that a new generation of people coming to the First World War didn't have that chance to meet them. And perhaps through stories like this, they get a bit of an insight into them. And the incredible recordings of these men that are on sites like the Imperial War Museum Sound Archive really is worth listening to hear their perspective of the war. So back to Arras. Arras today is a battlefield that is infrequently visited compared to Ypres and the Somme, but nevertheless a battlefield worthy of our interest. Many go to Vimy Ridge. The magnificent Canadian Memorial dominates that part of the battlefield. But in the quiet lanes around Arras, walking on the high ground around Wancourt or through the lanes of Monchy-le-Preux or across where Tunnel Trench was, where Siegfried Sassoon was wounded in April 1917, or down to Bullecourt, it's an amazing battlefield to go and visit. And there are many great books on this subject that I'd recommend. Jeremy Banning and Peter Barton's book on Arras, Jim Smithson's book on Arras, and for me, one of my favourites, John Nichols' Cheerful Sacrifice. I've known John for many years. He's a great author. Like me, he interviewed hundreds of veterans of the Great War. And there is some amazing stories that he's put in there of the Battle of Arras. from characters like Alfrazel, another veteran that I was very, very lucky to know. Great book. But when you consider that I can only recommend a handful of books on Arras, then you'll realise that it is an underrepresented battle in the literature of the Great War. But there are many memoirs that that cover it as well. So today, many of us with family connections to Arras, or it being a battlefield that we've visited, will be thinking of those places around Arras in this strange world in which we're currently living. We can't go there today, but our minds can wander across that old front line, and we can think of the men of the Battle of Arras who fought there 103 years ago today. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Old Front Line with me, military historian Paul Reed. If you've enjoyed this podcast, do take time to subscribe, follow me on Twitter at Somcor, and tell us what you think using the hashtag Old Front Line. I look forward to seeing you again along the old front line.